Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hey there, thanks for choosing the Driven Chat podcast. I'm Andy Jay, and I'm very pleased to say, as ever, I'm sat with my compadres, Amy Shaw.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you very much. And Monsieur Markar.
Good afternoon, or morning, or evening. Whatever time you listener are listening, good day to you.
It's well saved. once again, we are in the haunted room at Caffeine and Machine, bringing you a little bit of ghostly lockdown loving because, well, we are with El Jefe right now. I'm extremely excited. There's a man sitting on the sofa looking like the Don, because he is. It's Phil McGovern. How are you doing, Phil?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for being here. It's not haunted, just for a fact, right? That was a story that we seeded right from the beginning. It's wonderful. This was supposed to be the room of races past. You know, there was supposed to be a wall all the way along that wall that you come in on was supposed to be just a load of faces of interesting motorsport stars from bygone eras.
So you're telling us that there isn't actually a ghost?
Yes, there is.
Yeah. let's
you
work on
never
it. If there's not a ghost, like
so Sterling is hovering somewhere.
In 100 years' time, it'll be the ghost of Markar.
Well, why did the wall never become a thing? That sounds awesome.
I just think it was a bandwidth thing, Amy. To be fair, there was so much stuff that we wanted to do. We had this mega list when we first started rolling with this, and we'd look around the property and think, "This would be great. This would be good. This would be excellent." Reality sets in.
Well, I mean, I can imagine this place continuing for many, many years. So these are ideas that can be kept for future years of Caffeine and Machine.
They're completely and utterly time-free. There's no constraints to whatever it is that we want to add into this kind of like, it's texture on texture on texture, isn't it? So the more that you add in, the better. And it's probably why we started with the white building.
It's absolutely bang on. I mean, Phil, we were privileged enough a few podcast episodes ago to sort of sit down with Dan Macken and get a bit of a backstory about the creation, etc. But, you know, I don't think it's unfair to say this is your baby. This is your brainchild.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? And I think I've gotten used to this now that, yes, it all started way before I met Dan, but the reality of what it became was with Dan, full stop. Mm. You know, it's very easy. What was it? This terrible old saying that ideas are cheap, and they kind of are. It's the delivery that takes
all the money.
Yeah, I mean, it was a painful experience, but without Dan, materially, this thing wouldn't exist to the level that it does.
I mean, one of the amazing things, though, Phil, is that, you know, Caffeine and Machine is now, this building has been open to the public for a little over 2 years now. You've just celebrated your second
Annoyingly, this fellow was the first person to activate anything at Caffeine and Machine. I'm referring to John, obviously.
Well, and how much has that hindered your progress? No, but the fact of the matter is, you know, we like to deal in facts as well as kind of fancy. And the reality is that Caffeine and Machine, this building, the people that have come here, the awareness of the brand, etc., it exploded instantly. I mean, it was a hit from the start.
Yeah, it was bizarre. It was very, very bizarre. We put a lot of effort. The hardest part was converting the digital footprint from a Middle Eastern footprint to a relevant UK footprint. Because I think I kicked the start of the social media channels back into 2015. And they were very much focused in the Middle Eastern market, right? Mm.
You know, I remember lots of photos of
90% of my customer base and consumer base and those that were actually connected to the page were Middle Eastern, completely irrelevant to this.
So you thought, I know what, I need Stratford-upon-Avon.
And I don't know whether that was probably false position desires, but there was a self-belief in the concept that it was far bigger than Dubai could ever cater for. And I felt scared that I'd looked at so many of these entrepreneurial startup businesses that had happened in Dubai and none of them had left. Mm-hmm. None of them had got out. Dubai as a country was built on the back of brands being brought in. Everything was brought in from Shake Shack to the hotels to any food concept that popped up in the Middle East already existed in another market. And I felt that if we were going to give Caffeine and Machine the legs that it actually needed, there was no way that it was going to work in that country for a number of factors, political, economic, being an Englishman in the Middle East. Mm. I felt like this was more capable.
So let's go. Way more capable. When we spoke with Dan gave us a good backstory about the foundations of Caffeine and Machine. And yes, it started off as a brand that was based in the Middle East, then ended up here.
Yeah.
But I think what a lot of people don't know is if we wind the clock back even further, pre Caffeine and Machine, you've got quite an interesting history in the world of automotive.
Yeah, I hustled a little bit.
But it's common to hear that from people that have done fairly well or had successful positions in the automotive industry. But give us an oversight for those, because there will be a lot of people listening that don't know, for example, your involvement in Jaguar Cars was fairly substantial.
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky that I was brought up offshore. My father he went hunting Middle East danger money, let's put it that way, in the late 70s and found himself in Saudi. So I was born and raised in Saudi. I spent a lot of time in Qatar subsequent to that and then Malaysia and then came back to the UK.
So are you multilingual?
I have this canny knack of being able to listen and understand Arabic to the point where my Arabic friends stopped talking Arabic in front of me. I couldn't retort or converse, but you know this as well as I do, Tommy. Yeah. You get to a certain point where there's certain phrases, certain words, and then you can just match it together and you can respond and go, no, that's not exactly how it worked out, is it, Faisal? And Faisal went, it's like, well, mate, if you count back over the last 4 years of knowing you, I've asked you pertinent questions to understand what you're saying.
Hello, Faisal, by the way.
Yeah, hello, Faisal. So we, as a family unit, my parents bought a house in Kenilworth in a place called Bullymore Grove, which is just as you hit Kenilworth, there's like 67 houses tucked away in there. And there was a high propensity of JLR, back then Jaguar employees and Land Rover. And there was three in there, maybe three and a half, four, because the fourth one was just a friend who didn't really help influence where I went. But there was four very strong characters. There was a guy called Barry Thrussell. There was a guy called
Roger. What a name.
That was a good
Barry
name.
Yeah. Thrussell.
So Barry Thrussell was awesome.
You would cast Barry Thrussell. Barry was basically anything.
Yeah.
Barry, who do we need for this Barry Thrussell?
What was he? What was he back then? I think he was head of marketing and sales and service or something.
He deserves. He does all the titles.
He was a cool guy, right? He was the guy that had... you know, he had the crazy kind of like turbocharged Daihatsu Charades and the interesting VTEC Civics, and he had the first E46 M3 I ever experienced. Wow. He had the first 911 I ever experienced,
and all
the
first STDs.
CBR 400 that I ever experienced.
Yeah, nice.
He had all of these mega toys. Thoroughbred petrol head.
Was he a massive player? Because
he
you
was
know, with
just
that name.
Awesome. He was just an awesome guy, and he had two kids. And obviously, I got to know Barry because his daughter became my babysitter. Simple, really, and that was the connection into Barry. And then there was a gentleman called Roger Craythorne. And Roger, I will position him as Mr. Land Rover. I think a lot of people will position him as Mr. Land Rover, but he was Mr. Land Rover. At the time I got to know him, he was launching what now is known as Land Rover Experience.
Yeah, okay.
But he was the guy that did all the testing and shakedown of Project Velar all that time ago, right? He was the chap.
That was very
capable.
Ago.
Yeah, he was behind all the Camel stuff, the Experience stuff. He's the guy that drove that Defender County up the side of the dam.
Yeah, the dam, yeah.
He very famously wouldn't get in an aeroplane. Yet he travelled the world with Camel Trophy, but he did it all by road. Wow. Hence, I've got this deep-seated love affair of road trips, right? Because this guy used to regale these incredible stories to me whilst showing me Huey that he was restoring in the garage.
And to be fair, if you're going to avoid planes and you're the dude that runs the Camel Trophy, then you
travel.
You know, yeah.
The other guy, which charted a more significant course in my life, was a guy called David Shupak. And David at the time had been brought in to head up S-Type program. David, I'll surmise David as quickly as I can. He came from Ilmore, IndyCar kart guy, headed up Jaguar S-Type program. He then navigated his way all the way to the chief executive of engines and transmissions for Ford worldwide, and then left to become the chairman of Whirlpool. Where it became very interesting was he was head of exhaust and cooling for XJ220.
Ah.
So he was one of the 12 Saturday Club members. So my interconnection into XJ220 started with David. His son, Jonathan, became a very close friend and still is to this day, and he was the chief designer of Rivian. So they're as a family.
Nice.
They've navigated really beautifully. Jonathan's an amazingly talented fella that it was the babysitting lark, right? I was babysitting Jonathan.
Brilliant.
And then the final guy was a guy called Peter Horbury. And Peter lived right up at the top. And he, at the time, was chief designer of Volvo. Peter is still chief designer of Volvo.
Yeah.
But he now heads up the whole patch, right, that Geely got themselves involved with. Yeah. So I was mates with Ed and Nathan, his two kids. And that was this patchwork quilt of automotive inspiration. And then when I was 16... I wanted to find myself some work experience. David Shupak very kindly gave me work experience at Browns Lane for Jaguar Cars. So I went in at, when everyone else was getting pissed and making out in fields, I was cycling to either Whitley or to Browns Lane from Kenilworth as a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old to go and do my 6 weeks here, 4 weeks there, 9 weeks here.
So, and were you experience. Aware at the time of, because, you know, the four people you just mentioned, they are all outliers. They're all power players within the
it
brand.
It connected when I went to, I forget the year, but they launched what is now 405 Range Rover at L'Opera in Paris. It must have been 8 years ago now.
Yeah.
It was the same time they launched McLaren P1. And Roger was there. And it was then that I realised that when they roll out the big guns, it's Roger.
Oh, it's you guys.
Like, what are you doing here? It's like, well, I'm the brand. And then, yeah, you do. You track these people. And, you know, I only realized that David Shupak was part of the Saturday Club when I'd bought an XJ220 with my father. And I started looking through this
book. You've got an XJ220?
And I was like, holy God, David was part and parcel of this program. Mm. And there he is with this amazing moustache. And I sent him a message. And he went, yeah, I was part of XJ220. Did you never question why there were prototypes lying outside my house?
That's so good. I was at Don Laws just 2 weeks ago.
Mm.
Brilliant.
Don became... Yeah, I had to be that guy that phoned up Don. We'll get to the Don connection in a minute because it's actually quite funny. It was the XJ220 was the trigger reason I left corporate.
Okay.
So, we'll get to that in a tickle, which meant that I had to phone Don and then I had to listen to Don regale this story of this idiot that wrote this article and then posted it online about an abandoned XJ220 in the Middle East. And I'm at the time going, that was me. I was like, so now that you've said that, Don, we're looking to buy a car. And I didn't reveal that it was me until I met
Don the deal.
Don face to face. Yeah. But yeah, I was that guy. That charted everything. That completely changed my life, that car.
There was a fabulous story your dad has told me about your time working at Jaguar, which kind of propelled you fairly well into your success and your journey, which was a fairly interesting individual that came into a showroom to buy a couple of cars. Do you want to pick up from there?
And, oh, God.
Story. I've only heard your dad's version. So
I had many. Yeah.
Somebody involved in a rock band environment.
Yeah. So I... Yeah, we can accelerate the other bit because it's really boring. So I did my work experiences and then I finished my A-levels. I went to uni. Third year of uni, I wanted to do an industrial placement course because that was part of the structure of it. I managed to find myself in UK Ops, which is the kind of dealer-facing marketing team of the Jaguar UK national sales company. And I spent a lot of time traveling around the country because I landed as the UK sales director had lost his driving license for drink driving. And they went, "You're a young fella. You've got nothing to do. There's the keys to this guy's car driving around the country. Keep your gob shut, keep your ears wide open. And I've got big old flappers." So I spent a year sitting with this guy, John Johnson, traveling around the UK, understanding retail business.
Wow.
And variable marketing and this and that. And it was wonderful to experience all of that. And then I just bit off traveling, came back, worked in consumer affairs because I wanted nothing more than to pick up the phone to an angry person. So I did that. Oh, so much hard work. But I very quickly found myself in there was a room of four of us. I say a room. We were in the corner of this huge floor, but the four of us were the escalation program. So we were effectively the voice of the then chairman of the company. So if it went through all the pain, it came to us. And we had the discretion to pull you out of a car and replace it. And that was our kind of ultimate discretion level, was we could say, you know what, completely agree with you. We'll take that car back. There's another one. I met some very interesting people through that, which then led me to this desire of I want to go and sell cars. And I couldn't understand why no one within Jaguar at the time had ever done retail. No one within Jaguar had ever bought their own car. They all get company cars, right?
Yeah.
They'd never walked into a showroom because they get their company cars from company vehicles around the corner. Yeah. So they'd never gone through this process. And I couldn't grasp why that wasn't the case. So I put my hand up and said, I want to go and do retail sales. They couldn't facilitate it. So I phoned a couple of the local dealers and a gentleman called Simon Brown, who I've subsequently seen in the car park. He came over and said hello. He was just like, "Phil, the showroom's yours. Come and do it. But I'm going to pay £10,000 a year, basic, and the rest you have to figure out."
Ooh.
So I dumped out of Jaguar Land Rover, Jaguar, and went to work for Rybrook in Solihull. First car I sold was to a long-haired fella that rolled in he was an SL55 AMG. You know, remember the big bangers?
Yeah.
And said, "I'm interested in an XKR Silverstone." The guy turned out to be Tony Iommi. Tony led me to Bev Bevan. That led me to Geezer Butler. And it led me to some really, really interesting, because it ends up being member get member, right?
When, yeah.
When you're a good salesman, they kind of say, "Do you want to meet this guy? This guy would like to buy a car." So that charted a very interesting course for me. Then Pendragon, this monstrous retail outfit, bought all these little independent businesses. And I ran for the hills. I was like, I'm not being part of a big corporate machine. And Listers phoned me up and offered me, they were launching R8 at the time. So I became their R8 advocate. And I went and did 8 months at Listers. But my brain was scratching. I just couldn't help but continue to think I want to deliver something interesting. And at the time, it was this thing called Strawberry Jam, codename Smart 17, which was how to get 17-year-old, mass affluent 17-year-olds into a lease vehicle that was black boxed, insured, tracked, and modern, new, and safe, right? I couldn't get it off the ground. My auntie thought it was a terrible idea. My auntie's an incredible entrepreneur. She's done very well for herself over the years. And she was like, "It's an awful idea, Phil." And I went, "Yes, it is, isn't it?" And closed the book on it and went back to work for Jaguar Land Rover now, because Land Rover was part of it, and wanted to go and do the Middle East. So I got on an aeroplane to go to the Middle East after having a wonderful interview with a guy called Andrew Gawthorpe, who still to this day is the best boss I've ever had, bar none. I believe he's in Triumph now, very senior guy. And that was, I was area after sales manager in Dubai, and I looked after Algeria to Pakistan, sub-Sahara Africa. That was my patch.
So quite a strong patch.
Yeah. Mega patch, yeah.
And a few quid there.
Yeah, it was mega. And, you know, my job was to fly around and make sure that these guys were adhering to process. It was terribly dull. But I got to travel to amazing countries and meet amazing people. And I kept meeting myself, and I'd meet Amy, and I'd meet John, and I'd meet you. And it'd be like, this is repeating.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the beginnings of how I saw it coming. And then I found my love affair of the camera. But whilst I was traveling... My mum was a very successful artist. My dad, not so much. He was a civil engineer, but he was very good at drawing. My art became the camera. So I just started shooting everything I saw. You know, I was shooting stuff in Syria and Algeria and meeting interesting people, but I was documenting it for myself.
Yeah.
And I had nowhere to put it. So I started a website. And this was 10 years ago. And at the time, a very good friend of mine called Luke Ray, who was best man at my wedding, Luke was working for Ford, and I was effectively working for Ford, but JLR. And he and I met up over Christmas, and he said, I want to do journalism. I want to be a publisher. I was like, mate, I want to be a publisher too, but it's digital all the way. And he went, no, print. So he came up with Fuel, which then subsequently expanded into Fuel and Tank Moto. So he's got a car, hot rod car brand and a motorbike brand. And I started crankandpiston.com. And it was nothing more than just my way of getting my images out and not boring my mum and my then wife. And Crank and Piston was literally, it was car culture in the UAE, and it just started to grow. And it burbled, and I document the motorsport side of things. That was my lead in, because it was road racing culture. And we did it in two languages, English and Arabic. And then we tried to launch this really bizarre hybrid Lebanese language, which is letters and, you know, like Bissara written with a 7 and a 3 and a 5. We tried that for a bit. But the brand kind of resonated. It was right at the cusp of social. It was right at the cusp of digital content. I was in Qatar one afternoon, and I went walking down the back street, and there was an abandoned XJ220. It was ruined. It was bad. And I spoke to the guy, Mick Bramley, who was the service guy, and he's like, I saw this car when it was in Beirut like 9 months ago, and here's the photos. It's absolutely perfect. So I was like, I want to know the story. I need to find out the story. So I did a bit of digging, found out, posted it, knowing full well that the ramifications might be quite bad, and went live with it. Speed Hunters took it, Autoblog took it, Jalopnik took it, Top Gear took it, Autocar took it.
What happened? Like, give us the too long didn't
read.
It
was syndicated. So it was chassis 184, I believe, Lebanese car, dark blue, beautiful, found its way back into Qatar, because I think it was owned by the Emir of Qatar at the time. It then reappeared as, do you remember the London Motor Museum car? It was mean. Yeah. It had a roof scoop on it. It was satin blue. It was really badly trimmed. It had a horrible wing on the back. It became that car.
Right.
I wrote a piece that was a bit scathing. About second generation money not really being totally grasping the value chain. It was very much buy, sell, dispose. Mm-hmm. They've changed. You know, the generation that we're now very close to are very different. But back then they weren't. And every publication in the world wanted to syndicate this story. My website had 1.8 million hits overnight.
Wow.
I was offered my resignation as I walked in the next day.
Oh.
Because The gentleman that had owned the car had made contact with the then CEO of JLR, who I think was Mike O'Driscoll. Mike O'Driscoll made a phone call to my boss, went, who's this fella? Mm. Oh, he's my area sales guy. Like, he's gone and done this. Like, Robin knew full well that I was doing this website. And he very softly and kindly said, make a choice, Phil. Shut the website and continue doing this wonderful job or leave.
How quickly did you make the decision?
8 days. 8 days.
Really? It wasn't just an instant?
No, because I had no way of backing it up. So I went to my dad and went, you've seen this wonderful website that I created. This could be the future. It'll make us millions. My dad very, very kindly stumped up some Benjamin Franklins and a young fella called Bassam Cromfley, Lebanese-Canadian guy, who at the time was publishing Evo magazine and a product called Automart, which was basically a fast-moving quarter, bi-weekly retail proposition, car sales, auto trader print, basically. And went, I'll invest, and you can run Evo, Automart, and you can bolt this crank and piston proposition into the side.
No.
So we can have two print and a digital. And I went to him, that's super. How about we break it all down and we deliver a company that white labels content? And he went, I don't know how that works, but think about it. 3 weeks later, Robin Colgan phoned me up and went, we are launching an open contract for Jaguar Land Rover MENA, so Middle East, North Africa, Pakistan's social media and content program. Would you like to be the third wheel? Because you have to have three pitches, right?
Yeah.
So I went up against two big WPP agencies as myself. I pretended I had three employees. I didn't. and I won the contract. And I held it all the way until Spark 44 took it.
Wow.
So the white labeling side of the business took off very, very quickly. And then Maserati asked us to do their championship, and then Porsche, and then McLaren, and it just started to burble and roll. And then a young Saudi fella, I met him in the car park of the Dubai Autodrome. It was a January, wasn't it? Dubai 24 Hours. Big 6'5", bald-headed monster came wandering over to me. And I became very good friends with this chap. And he commissioned me to do some work for his race team called Saudi Falcons. And we did a load of content of the Saudi Falcons. And then Faisal asked me one day, do you want to go into business? So I left my first company. I literally walked away from it all. Walked away from Crank and Piston, walked away from all the contracts and the staff, and went into business with Faisal Bin Laden, and created a company called White Space Factory.
Goodness,
when everyone goes left, I go right.
And I mean, apologies if this is a very ignorant question. You said Faisal Bin Laden, mm-hmm. as in.
So the Bin Laden family is a very, very, very interesting family. Yeah. If you imagine, there's so Mohammed Bin Laden, father, and his brother at the time left Yemen all those years ago and made their way up to Saudi Arabia by foot. Sadly, brother two didn't make it. Proves how arduous that journey was all those years ago. Yeah. He then went on to have 11 wives and 52 children.
Yeah.
And SBG, Saudi Bin Laden Group, as we know it, became a thing, right? One of the biggest companies in the world, bar none. And they had fingers left, right, and center. Faisal was the eldest son of the second in command, a guy called Sheikh Saad. Faisal was, we got on like a house on fire, right? We absolutely hit it off. We had the same sentiment in life. We had the same belief mechanisms. We had the same passion sets. And we got on with it. And Faisal's job back then was to kick a door open, and my job was to run in before it shut. So he'd go, Phil, this is Mike. Mike runs McLaren. I'm going to get a drink. And he'd leave. And I'd be like, hello, Mike. I'm Phil. What's your surname? Okay, and this is Ron. Hi.
And two lovely men.
Yeah. And it led me down some very strange routes. Not least things like McLaren, Aston, the Singer relationship that I brought to the table that then we collaborated on and brought Singer to the Middle East. And I was just consistently hovering around in the background.
And so your role in this in this situation was literally to bring the product, the cars, etc.
My job was to network and conceptualize feasible propositions.
So McLaren, for example, you know, they obviously now have the Bahrain International Circuit, etc., etc. Was that, I mean, is that partly
what
down
were we
to
doing back for
you
McLaren
having?
Back then? We set lap records all around the Middle East in McLaren P1s. We worked behind the scenes on the retail proposition for McLaren in Saudi because the Bin Ladens wanted it. We did 7,000 miles across Saudi and collected every single McLaren 12C owner on the way.
That was with
so we started Salaf. We started in Riyadh, and then made our way. I'm going to have to get this right. This sounds terrible. I have to go northeast. So we went across the eastern province all the way up to Bereda, which is a very, very conservative part of Saudi. I got told to cover my ankles that day. And then we drove right across the center, kind of hovering underneath Iraq and all the way to Syria, to Yimba, and then south to Jeddah to the Talmoreeb Road, which was the first road that the Saudi Bin Laden Group built, which is effectively to you and I the Christian highway. So if you want to go to Mecca as a Christian, you can't. So you have to take this road, and it's called the Al-Hada Road. It's the most magnificent road you've ever been on.
It is.
And it was built by the Bin Ladens. That was their first road. They customized machines to build that road. And it took, I don't know, 9 years plus.
So when all this was happening, because, I mean, you were right in the heart of so many different things.
Mm.
Were you aware of how...
God, no.
Utterly.
No. Might be overwhelming if you were.
No. Yeah, it was all very surreal. Like... incredibly surreal.
Yeah.
And Faisal was wonderful at delivering that side of life, right? They all are. They're like, oh, Phil, you need to meet Jay. Well, hello, Jay Leno.
Yeah.
This is really weird. Hey, Phil, do you want to come and see my car collection? Like, yes, of course. Like, why am I here?
I had a Jay Leno story like that with Ian Callum.
Yeah. It's like, why? Ian's another one. Like, why am I here? This is really weird. But I just did my best and... tried to not look shaky, and put my mask on, right? The lads downstairs now, the team that are at C&M, still question how I can just put this face on. And it's just,
Yeah,
I'm 41 now. I've put my mask on far so many times that you just had to get on with it. And that was where it started to grow, and I started to kind of question all of these things that I'd seen in the scene and the industry. And you know, Faisal and I were traveling around. We were making good content. We did a lot of stuff for Drive, like a lot of stuff for Drive. I had the opportunity to sit down with JF Mutual and Christian Schnedler, the two guys that own or did own Drive back then, with Mike Spinelli and Chris Harris and all that crew. And they went, you know social media, do it. I was like, really? You're going to give me the keys to Drive? Like, give me the keys to Drive. Like, now, give me the keys and I'll show you what I can do. And I absolutely set fire to it. And it was amazing. And we just broke down content and started throwing out snippets. And we put a cadence in and we put a story in. And I was sat in the back end. And I could be the voice of five different people. So it was mildly psychotic. You know, I could sit there and be Matt Farah and be really angry, or I could be really passive and be Mike Spinelli, or I could be a real knob and be... you could have a bit of fun. And we weren't taking any shit off anyone online as a brand. We were just standing firm to our values. And Drive then led me to Momo. And I met a wonderful guy called Enrique Cisneros that owns Momo. And he had half a million fans on that page at the time. And he went, it's useless. I've got like 0.5% engagement. Like, mate, give me the channel for like 2 months and then you'll pay me a retainer. And he went, sure. 2 months later, he phoned me up and went, we're going to give you a retainer. And then he said, what would you do with Momo? Why is this guy asking me these questions? So we came up with this thing called Momo Heritage. And we started relaunching Prototipos and Monza steering wheels and Indie steering wheels and did a tie-up with Magnus Walker. And
oh, I love
him. Just became
I call him Uncle Magnus. He's such a lovely bloke, isn't he?
It became a lot of fun. And it was really, really interesting. And throughout all of this, I had this bloody cafe idea consistently blatting in the back of my head. It was going to be Crank and Piston Cafe, and it was going to have Hot Wheels on the ceiling. but, you know, I lost Crank and Piston, and then I got given this opportunity. So my time at White Space Factory was beginning to slow. I didn't really need to be there as often as I was at the time. And I was scratching around, and I met a guy called Mortaza in Dubai, who was a Standard Chartered banker, and he had this lovely cafe roastery place connected to motorbikes called Cafe Rider. And I walked in and went, oh, this guy's built exactly what I want. But where are the cars? A bit weird. Like, Mortaza, can I do a car event here? He's like, absolutely, knock yourself out. Cafe in a machine. It was the Thursday before Yas Formula One in November 2015. And he said, it's all yours, right? I was like, super. So we're going to do an event, and it's going to be 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, cars, bikes, and art. That's it. One night only. And I phoned Talal. Mm-hmm. I phoned Maximilian Cooper. I phoned Tim Burton. And I phoned Alex Penfold. Mm-hmm. They were the only four people I called. 400 people turned up. Caffeine and Machine began. And then the challenge was to do it again. And then the challenge was to make people realize that Cafe in the Machine was just an event at Cafe Rider. So we started to move it around the town, and it started to grow, and then social media pages started to come, and it just took over. And then dreams and aspirations started to like really push it towards, we should do a business plan, we should go and find some investment. And then I found myself as the chief marketing officer of a bank.
I was expecting that sentence.
Yes, of course.
You know when that happens sometimes. I didn't
understand it. So I got approached as the owner of the agency first. And they said, look, we'd very much like to entertain the idea of your agency doing all of our marketing and our social and our content and strat and all that sort of stuff. And then they just said, look, how about we throw this a complete curveball your way? How about you come and actually take the seat? I had a long chat with Faisal at the time. And that was the beginning of the downfall of my relationship with Faisal, really, because I think he felt like I'd left him.
Right.
When in actual fact, the needs of life were far more significant than I think he understood. And I needed to sort stuff out. You know, I had a mortgage, I had two mortgages and two kids and a wife that wasn't working, and I needed to go and do something. So I found myself in this bank startup, which was hugely exciting. You know, it was a digital neobank in a very overly saturated banking market that could be wild. You know, I know Dan touched on it. And it was mega. And it gave me complete freedom of how to market a proposition. And I just drilled it back to the really simple stuff of wants and needs and features and benefits. It's like, what's the average want and need of a human? It's always to live and survive. And what does a bank provide you? That. So we started this whole proposition of think clearly. And the bank enables you to just get on with your stuff. Dan and I met there. And he was a business analyst out of Barclays. And I was the guy in the corner of the room looking a bit weird with my motorbike helmet on. And I was not your general CMO. I was dressed pretty much like this, but I'd turn up on my Bonnie and I had my helmet on.
Cool.
And I hid in the corner of the room. I've always been the guy that hides in the corner of the room. Not for being odd. It's just I need my space. Right. And I'm odd. But I just like my space. I can't think. The minute another voice appears in a conversation, I go deaf. Mm. It's so strange. It's like I can't compute. I need to go out. And I think Dan kept wandering over and just going, what are you doing? Going on in there, Phil? And we started talking about customer retention and customer reach out and networking. And he was like, have you ever tested it before? And I was like, yeah, I have. I've got this thing called Caffeine and Machine. He's like, ooh, talk to me about it.
And boom.
And the rest is the future.
Yeah. So at that stage, I was right at the end of testing. And I had one more to go. And it was the Dubai Ports Monster, which was laid out to be a free event. So all our traders that were coming, everyone that was down wasn't being charged. They just had to reveal their numbers. I needed to see their revenue numbers because I knew that we could do costings better or different. So just give me your revenues. And Dan was like, I'm going to come down. He had a broken collarbone at the time because he dumped a KTM 450 in the desert. So he had his arm in a sling. It was 45 degrees Celsius. It was way too hot and sticky. We're running around trying to wrangle 4,500 people. And it was a mega, mega day. And at the end of it, we kind of sat down and I said to him, dude, look at this. This is a really interesting set of numbers. And he just opened his laptop and got Excel out. Wow. Like, you got a business plan? I'm like, yep. And then we just spent weeks and weeks and weeks just tearing it to shreds and looking at investment routes and figuring it out. And then the world tipped upside down because I had to leave the country.
Because?
So, visas, life, business partners. Yeah, it's a strange country, the Middle East. You give everything to it, and the minute you don't comply with the minor issue rules, you've got to leave. Mm-hmm. I had to sell my house. My dad had to sell his house. I had to back out of business, had to close bank accounts, had to do absolutely everything, and we were out of the country in 45 days.
Crazy.
Oh, wow.
It was quite intense. And I had to explain to my children the country that they were born in.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
They were leaving. We extricated and came back to the UK. And we still were nowhere near this. Like, you have to realize that in the July preceding the December of finding this place, we still had no idea what we were doing.
Yeah. I remember getting a phone call from you.
No idea.
I can't think what time of the year it was. And it was kind of like, I've heard of you through Al Clark and through a few other people.
You got the guy I saw trying to do a burnout in the snow on a motorbike. Yes. On a Driftworks video. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, you got my number from somewhere and said, you know, I've got this idea. Here's what we're hoping. Don't know if you might be able to be involved or help or give some ideas. And I remember I was outside of my office. I had a little office down in East Horsley in Surrey, and I was pacing up and down the little shop parade in East Horsley, thinking, I can't work out if this guy is completely off his rocker. Like, I couldn't work out what you were trying to
do. I think that was Charlie Turner's quote from Top Gear.
Yeah,
like, you're either mad or this is going to be amazing.
And I came off the phone feeling really excited, and I went back into the office, and a couple of my guys in the office were like, well, what was that on the phone? I was like, I don't really know, but I think it's going to be brilliant.
It was all a bit mad. And the strategy was really simple. And I think I've only mentioned this a few times, but I took a massive IKEA clock, and I looked at the IKEA clock and I cut the scene up into 12 segments. Mm. And then I looked at the production that was connected to those 12 elements. And then I looked at the people that were making the content. There was only five, mm-hmm. six. So I spoke to them. That's really? Where it began. Because then the route just went...
Yeah,
it's the same reason that I have Amy hanging on the walls, right? Is everybody sat within that 12-hour clock that I looked at, and it might have been Wayne who built the bar. He got me into the hot rod world. Mm-hmm. Doing bits and bobs with Phil and Al got me into the JDM world, mm-hmm. and then it kind of went. And then then Charlie Turner, and then Wookie put extensive levels of work in, and everybody just kind of clubbed into this thing. And it was all a bit aloof and a bit weird and a bit unknown because it was still a shitty building site. Mm. And I think that's when Charlie went, if this is real and you're not absolutely sending me a curveball, this will work.
Love it.
Yeah, and then that led us up to opening weekend. And I think it was James Walker that hit the final nail in the coffin, actually, because he came in like 4 days prior, I think. Yeah. And whipped together a YouTube video that went live. I think it started with me singing behind the coffee machine.
He did.
Because he walked in and I was probably still in my pants making a coffee. And he launched it. And we shut it. We shut 4 minutes before we were due to open. Because we were full.
Brilliant.
And then that was the beginning of the mess that was the last 2 years.
I have to say, just listening to that unfold, I've been absolutely on tenterhooks listening to this and just captivated by this amazing journey. And clearly, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit, the risk taking, the adventures that you've been on are unbelievable. But the consistent thing is that you have been fearless and you've had ideas that other people haven't spotted. You've seen niches where you're
still surprised that people haven't done it.
But you're a visionary. I mean, you know, without kind of blowing smoke up your ass, that's clearly the situation. You don't do that level of things in those different territories. You don't get doors open like that unless you're going to do something special through those doors.
And it's taking that opportunity when it lands in front of you and doing the best you can. Mm-hmm. But it's also having the respect to say no once in a while. Mm-hmm. You know, I was asked to do things that sounded wonderful. And, you know, in hindsight, looking back now, probably doable. But at the time, it was far more... professional, just to say, with all due respect, no. And there was a layer to that that was Faisal, really. Faisal had this thing. He kept saying, chill pill. You need a chill pill, Phil. Slow down. He just kept saying to me, slow down. You know, breathe slow, walk slow.
I need someone to say that to me. You know, guys, tell me to slow
you
down.
Do. I'd say you would benefit a lot from a month in Saudi Arabia doing things on Saudi timelines. Because until I worked with, I think my time in Saudi, I've done a few bits and pieces and worked with a lot of Saudis. And I remember initially thinking, this is the most frustrating, impossible thing in the world. I can't get anything done. It's just a nightmare. And then something inside just clicks and goes, well, but it always works in the end. And it is. It's this crazy mentality which is so frustrating when you're from the UK, you know, the British way of doing things and the efficient, oh, I've said I'm going to be there at six, so I'll be there at six, and you realize actually none of that really matters that much. Things will always work out as long as you've still got the drive and the idea and the ambition. It doesn't matter if the road is a bit rocky on the way, you'll get there.
You
so just
it.
Don't worry about
you
it
absolutely got to run.
So that leads
Wise
me to
words.
Question Phil, you know, you're you know, we're sitting here in non-haunted roommate. You know, it is, without any shadow of a doubt, a colossal success. I'm not going to ask about the financials. That's not our business. But clearly, as a product, as a brand, smashed it.
Think of it as a swan.
Okay.
Looks good, but underneath it's been a constant.
Paddling. Of course. Crazy. No, I mean, you don't get this level of attention and success, etc., without putting a crazy shift in. And I mean, John's, you know, told me of the many, 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 many thousands of hours that have gone into this from so many different people.
Well, it's an 18-hour day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, and I completely I connect with that because this mad adventure, because we're more than a podcast, we're a bunch of other things. Yep. Don't need to go into that now. I guess my question is, now that you're here 2 years in plus, and given your story of just how many different things and how your brain clearly is always, what's that? What's that? That could work. Why don't we do this, that, and the other? So my question is simply, are you settled now or are you thinking?
No, worse now than I've ever been.
Really?
Yeah, because the opportunities that are now here that sit in front of us are far greater than they. Back then they were aspirational. Now they could quite conceivably be reality quite quickly. And it's down to the bandwidth that we've got and the time that we've got to put into it.
Specifically around the caffeine and machine brand.
Yeah. There's many elements that could be tacked to this. There's many elements that could, I don't know, without being aloof and weird, you could multiply this numerous times over. You know, the question mark is how many England could take, but there's no reason why you couldn't have five or six in the States quite easily.
You could have five or six in England. You know,
yeah, so it's multi-layered in that regard, in the simple repetition, copy-paste of what we've got here. Mm-hmm. But then you've got everything that feeds into it. You've got the product that feeds into it. You know, we could do so many kind of brand extensions off this that it's uncanny. The goal for me now is just to be able to do what Amy does every day for free. So I want to work hard at this to get back to just picking
up. You can come on
up.
The pod anytime, Phil. If that was the question. If this was a long
elaborate.
We'll do a job swap, you know. Yes. I'll do caffeine.
I just want to be that. I want to get back. The core for me, and which is why I still do it, is the capturing of what's going on outside, right?
Right.
And, you know, I still take the photos. I still run the social media accounts. You know, no one else is involved in any of that. Because that's what I love, and that's the core of this. It's going to be really difficult when there's two locations.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Clearly.
And three.
Then it starts to get hard. So, you know, Dan and I are looking at different conversations now that I probably never thought that I'd be looking at. It's like, how are we going to replace ourselves?
Yeah.
Or how are we going to get the next host? How are we going to find the next person that's the right person to be sat at the front of CNM Seattle, you know? And who's going to be that person? So... The challenge.
Fun challenges to have.
Yeah,
though, right?
Yeah. And it's great. And you know, we've got silly aspirational ideas from everything from insurance to car detailing products to an entire clothing line that we're just beginning to play with. But, you know, CNM as a brand is massive. Caffeine and Machine as a brand is also really, really interesting. Oh, mate, it's wherever you want to send your head, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, Dan and I, we've got this thing now where we do a 720. So we come up with an idea and we circle it once and then we go, circle it again. Yeah. So we go round it again and again and then again, and then we come out with a comfort zone because we have to agree. That's our rule. No agreement, no bueno. No, you don't go. It has to be a mutual agreement. So yeah, we debate over and over and over again. And you can imagine the amount of debates that we've had about what's happening on Thursday.
Yes,
of course.
You know, it's how we navigate that next step.
So to give the listener some context of that, we're recording this. 2 days ago, Boris Johnson decided we were entering a second lockdown. So this pod will air in about 2-3 weeks.
Yeah.
So we will be in the lockdown when this goes out. And we, Driven Chat and the affiliates, were due to have a weekend here at Caffeine and Machine.
We were really looking forward to it. Night here, we had food,
loads of crazy, fun, mad things planned, and it was going to be glorious. And of course, because of Boris, we've had to shut that down.
You'll have to come and join us for 12 Days of Christmas, won't you?
Absolutely.
Yes. That'd be great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So again, yeah, it's a constant chit-chat. So we navigated the first lockdown. That was very interesting for Dan and I and the entire business. You know, I think we found common solace in each other. It was really painful. It was quite difficult. You know, at some stages, neither of us thought we were going to pop out the other side.
Because it was flat out, wasn't it? From the minute... The doors opened that first weekend, I think, back to us standing outside in the mud and the rain for a year and a half. It was every single day you were on the rev limiter. The governor was getting hit every single day. And then suddenly it stopped.
Yeah.
It was literally like someone came along, flicked the switch, dead. Gone.
That's exactly what they did. But to every business, to every venue.
And then my dad sent me this thing. So in like 1991, we were living in Malaysia at the time, and I'd built this weird diorama of a car dealership stroke cafe out of cardboard and toilet rolls. And I had it filled with Matchbox cars, and it was sat on the grass out the back of the flat. And this is in 1991. I've got it somewhere. I'll dig it out. And my dad sent it to me, and he went, does this feel weird? And I'd already stepped ahead of his thought process. It felt like the diorama that I'd created when I was nine was empty. Because I was sat up on the hill. I stayed here for that 4 month stint. And you are sat up on the hill on an afternoon as the sun comes down, having a G&T, watching the world go by. Silence.
Yeah.
And it felt really weird, like way weird from this place that was having, you know, we were doing 16, 17, 18,000 people a month through the door to Dave, none, who was saying, are you guys open? Mm. Like, mate, it's locked down. Probably should go home. So we got ourselves reopened again. This one that we're about to venture into now is probably a little bit more open to interpretation. So I think we're just looking at the feasibility of doing takeaway, and we're looking at the feasibility of how this, that, and all the other bits will work.
Ethically, how much will you stay open? Because you also
just
want
nailed
to be
it
like,
on the head there. Yeah. I mean, that's the biggest problem I've got when I'm sat in this room of seven or eight people that we've got, like in our first line team, is I'm the dude in the corner going, morally, this is the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, no matter how many economic holes are left in his speech, we probably should be shut.
Mm.
Because we're different to pub X in the countryside. If we say we're open for takeaway, we're going to have a car park full of people.
You are.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be that guy. So, you know, we're going to navigate it. We're going to watch it. And anything that makes either myself or Dan materially uncomfortable will be the reason that we make a change.
We've had to do exactly the same thing. You know, we could, looking at the rules, we could take our truck on the road. We could go to celebrities' doorsteps as we have been. But there are risks attached.
There are.
You know, and you just... You're right. Morally, you have to think it through.
Yeah.
You know, so, we're taking the cautious first approach as well.
Yeah. You know, big time. Big time. And we're going to look at that, and we're going to probably communicate something in the next couple of days that will see sense, I hope.
Okay.
That's the challenge.
You've been just a brilliant guest.
I think this is the quietest we've all been. Like, just
it is, yeah.
To you, somebody talk.
I've known you a while now, and there were a few things there I didn't know. So this has been quite nice to actually
listen. That's my mum's training in life, right? Keep counsel on occasion.
Well, thank you for sharing with us.
No, an absolute pleasure, guys. Really appreciate it's so nice that you're doing what you're doing. There's a massive gap hole in the market, and run.
Well, thank you so much for having us along, and just us being here is a real, real pleasure. So thank you.
Your support and accommodating us is... It does mean the world, so we really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Please keep coming.
We will.
We will.
I'm going to say something now that I've never said, but I'm going to go and talk to Quentin Wilson now.
Yeah, he's a lovely guy.
How amazing is that?
He's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
Brilliant. This has been another episode of the Driven Chat podcast. We also have a celebrity variant. If you fancy something different for a change, check out the Driven Celebrities podcast. Meantime, we have a massive back catalogue. If you're not a regular, then welcome. If you are a regular, thank you. We'll be back next week.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Oh, wow. You've made it to the end. The very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven podcast in your preferred podcast app, or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.